The following podcast is a live recording of a radio show, first broadcast by Fresh FM, with the assistance from New Zealand On Air.
Greetings, everybody. It's lovely to have your company for today's episode of Climate Matters. I'm Lindsay Wood. I'm the Director of Climate Strategy Company Resilience. And Climate Matters is brought to you by Fresh FM, Top of the South's community access radio station. It's also broadcast across the Canterbury region on Plains Media and to the southern end of the North Island on Arrow FM. Well, today we're going into Climate Matters 150. But before we do that, quite an important announcement, because between now and the elections, Climate Matters is changing up a gear. And so what we're doing is we're running 20 or so interviews with experts, and it's under a series called Front Footing the Future, trying to get our climate policy fit for purpose. We will be interviewing scientists and professors of sociology and wahine Māori and energy people and all sorts. So do look out for that. And to mark the change, after 264 episodes of starting and finishing with the wonderful version of Vivaldi's Four Seasons that is played by the Elbe Philharmonic Orchestra, we are now going to change and move on to a theme soon called Rise and Shine by the band Beacon Pie, and it's the courtesy of Uploads. You will hear that soon, and so a big thanks to the Elbe Philharmonic. If we have time, I'll give you a bit more on the Elbe Philharmonic music as a final farewell to it. Anyway, so here we go into Climate Matters number 150, which was actually published on the 13th of April. So here's what we're going to be covering. We're going to touch on the biggest lesson from Artemis II, the moon probe. Hoping the ship arrives isn't a strategy. There'll be a quiz question. We actually got a little bit from Minister Mark Mitchell. Please explain complacency to the Prime Minister. And then the New Zealand government makes transparency more invisible. Another one, a welcome oxymoron, industrial-scale regenerative forestry. A little intriguing item from the Can You Believe It files, the United States gas price goes negative. Then a hot energy tip for winter. And finally, a CPR for a Planet blog recommendation. So let's see about Artemis 2, because I love it when something shines a spotlight into a corner of my brain that sends my thoughts spinning off in another direction. And forgive me this little indulgence. I hope you enjoy it. Many of us marveled and thrilled at the Artemis 2 expedition, or did double takes of that, those amazing views and reversal of the moon and the Earth, with the Earth in the, quotes, sky, close quotes. Some of us even think the supposed quest to mine the moon and inhabit Mars are the stupidest of ideas, symptoms of our failure to make things work in the wonderful place we already live. But for me, the most poignant and compelling lesson has been the refreshing of a perspective of just how precious and lonely is our planet home, our home planet. And I've got a treasured book called Just That, The Home Planet, and get a little bit of its legacy. It was jointly published in 1988 by Addison Wesley in the West and Mir Publishers in Moscow for the Association of Space Explorers, and it was dedicated to all the children in the world. Bear in mind, this was fairly early days in the era of spaceflight and so on. The book features fantastic images from Earth and of Earth from space, and one of the most telling things is the quotes that came from dozens of astronauts. And here's a bit from the preface by Oleg Makarov, and it's very telling. Here's, I'm quoting, "Cosmonauts don't say much, especially when we're on a mission. Usually some 5 to 7 seconds are enough for us to express the most complicated thought. Or so I thought, but then I was asked to listen to recordings of communications between mission control and the cosmonauts in space. To tell you the truth, I was amazed. Within seconds of attaining Earth orbit, every cosmonaut, without exception, be they a dry reserve flight engineer or a more emotional pilot, uttered the same sort of confused expression of delight and wonder. No one has been able to restrain his heartfelt wonder at the sight of the enthralling panorama of the Earth. The emotional outbursts lasted for 42 seconds on average. That's incredible. It just shows what an emotional pull our home planet has. Such feelings came through repeatedly in the book. Here's a couple more quotes. A cosmonaut, should he eat bread somewhere near Mars, baked from wheat raised in a space laboratory, will, believe me, think of the grain and flowers gathered on Earth. That's Dumitru Prunariu from Romania. Here's one from Mohammed Almad Faris from Syria. From space, I saw the Earth, indescribably beautiful, with the scars of international boundaries gone. What a evocative comment that is, with the scars of international boundaries gone. And here's another from Ernst Messerschmidt in Germany, or from Germany. When a Russian cosmonaut tells me the atmosphere over Lake Baikal is as polluted as it is over Europe, and when an American astronaut tells me that 15 years ago he could take much clearer pictures of the industrial centers than today, then I am getting concerned. Bear in mind that this goes back 40 years. And so just to close off this, 40 years later, pilot Victor Glover beamed in, "We love you," from the moon. You may recall that just as they were losing contact when they went behind the moon for, I think it was 40 minutes, was it? And then here's from Christina Koch, who said, "What struck me wasn't necessarily just Earth. It was all the blackness around it. The Earth was just this lifeboat hanging undisturbingly in the universe." That's our lifeboat, folks. Let's do a better job looking after it. And speaking of lifeboats of quite a different kind, here's a reference to an article headed up, "Hoping the Ship Arrives Isn't a Strategy." I've quoted Nathan Surendran's outstanding energy and resilience blog before. He gives lucid insights into how our energy system and our energy economy work. New Zealand desperately needs clear voices like his, such as, and we'll give a link to his "Hoping the Ship Arrives Isn't a Strategy" blog. Thanks also, Nathan, for recommending Nate Hagen's outstanding trilogy on the energy situation. I was going to reference them too, so Nathan saved me the trouble. Oil, I'm quoting from his blog, "Oil 101, Oil 201, and Oil 301 are the most useful 40 minutes of primer video currently available for understanding why what is happening should be of concern to us all." Nathan, I'll give links to his blog, plus links to the Nate Hagen's trilogy. But, and I've also put it, I've called it a warning. If you're not used to the sort of energy discussions that people like Nathan and Nate Hagen's conduct, you may feel inclined to listen twice to grasp the sort of things that they sometimes take for granted. Well worth the time spent. Energy is such an critical issue for our present and our future. Here's a quote from Nathan, which I think is very telling. "We have collectively been energy blind for so long that we don't know what we're looking at when it disappears." And here's one from Larry Blair, who I've also quoted. He runs the New Zealand Energy blog. I'm increasingly concerned about the economic heart attack we are going to have as a result of this oil and materials clot in the Strait of Hormuz. Now, bear in mind, I wrote that on the 13th of April. Today is the 3rd of May. I have just listened to a blog by Nate Hagen's talking to a global oil market expert, and it is very, very telling what he has to say. I will put a link to that into the show notes as well. Okay, I offered a quiz to you, or said there was a quiz. What is ectomycorrhizal? What is ectomycorrhizal fungal mycelium, and what is its significance? And I also said in the blog, bonus points if you can say it 10 times quickly. So I failed at the first hurdle there. We'll come to the answer in a little while. Okay, the next one. Dear Minister Mitchell, please explain complacency to the Prime Minister. It starts with a map of the North Island, the entire North Island, under orange or red wind warnings as Cyclone Vianu approached. Here we go. Dear Minister for Energy Management and Recovery, Mark Mitchell, you looked in your element in your Cyclone Vianu briefing, and we'll link to that. You seemed to cross the issues and explain things clearly. A comment of yours that especially struck me was on preparing for a possible emergency. We don't have the luxury of being complacent. How true. Minister, I urge you to explain that concept to the Prime Minister because he doesn't get it and has a case of complacency on steroids. Whether it's his it'll be all right on the night attitude to New Zealand Inc.'s tenuous oil reserves, hence going back to that comment or that blog by Nathan that I just quoted about the fact that a hoping the ship arrives isn't a strategy. So from that reference to Prime Minister's touching faith that the market will sort everything or his dogged and dogmatic refusal to heed climate science, Mr. Luxon clearly confuses complacency with cool-headed leadership. And you could do worse, Mr. Mitchell, and take the PM out to spend a night at one of those emergency stations your ministry has set up. That might sharpen his sense of reality. It would also give you a chance to drill into him that cyclones like Vianu are increasing in frequency and intensity thanks to a phenomenon known as climate change. Another thing Mr. Luxon clearly doesn't get. Otherwise, why would he be so pleased to promote policies that make it worse? Okay, more on the government, making transparency more invisible. A sure sign a government is doing stuff it doesn't want us to see is when it externalizes transparency, i.e. makes it harder to find out what's happening. Under the guise of saving cost, Minister Paul Goldsmith is reviewing the Official Information Act. A link will go to that. Former Prime Minister and constitutional law guru Sir Geoffrey Palmer understands this stuff, and his warnings in a newsroom article we'll link to deserve to be heeded. I'm quoting, "There are few statutes more important than the Official Information Act, but the Act can be unpopular with ministers and some public servants whose advice may be exposed to public view." And then later, he also quoting Geoffrey Palmer, "The minister has approached his review with a minimum of publicity." Palmer pointed to the particular irony that changes to an act promoting transparent government are flying under the radar. But, Geoffrey Palmer goes on to say, but it opens up such a can of worms, so many dangers that it could easily explode into a significant election issue. Too right it could, and we should put fuel on that fire to some degree too. Once again, our government confuses cost and value, and Palmer hit the nail right on the head with another statement of his. Of course, if the government is concerned with saving money, the best practice would be to increase the amount of official information that is proactively released. Then there would be far fewer OIA requests. Just to let you know what proactive releasing is it is when the government officially releases information about the processes leading up to a policy decision, for example, when they release it without having been asked for it as a part of an OIA request. And then I'll add to that two other things. A, the government should run a better legislative process in the first place. Goodness me, when they put shonky legislation through, they've got to expect people to want to understand how it came about. And B, stop the smoke and mirrors around OIA releases. If you're not sure about what I'm getting at there, I will post a link to a Resilience website. That's my company's website. We've got a web page called Willful Blindness about our attempts to get information from the government last year. Okay, jumping tracks completely. A welcome oxymoron, industrial scale, regenerative forestry. Here we go. In what seems like almost an oxymoron, The Guardian reports a giant industrialized forest regeneration project. The key process is inoculation on a vast scale of seedlings with, here we go, ectomycorrhizal fungal mycelium, a microbial cocktail that's, in quotes, teeming with hundreds of species of wild soil fungi. And if you can imagine an aerial view looking down on a tractor, and it almost looks like it's got rows of green carpet beside it, there are actually millions of tiny pine seedlings, and out of the tractor is coming a plume of spray, and it's the spray of this microbial cocktail that I've just mentioned. Colin Averill is the foundation of Startup Funga, and that supplies the cocktail. And their research has found that, and I'm quoting, the composition of soil fungal communities predicts forest growth and carbon sequestration as strongly as rainfall. That's astonishing. Trials between normal seedlings and inoculated ones are striking. We've seen growth responses in excess of 100%, he said, but on average they expect to achieve a 30% boost. That's really astonishing technology. I'd love to know how they get on and how big the uptake is. Okay, I promised an item from the Can You Believe It files. United States natural gas price goes negative. Bear in mind this was written in early April. I have no idea what the situation will be when you read or hear this. Here we go. While most fossil fuels were skyrocketing in price due to the Strait of Hormuz blockade, oil producers in the United States Permian Basin were paying customers to take natural gas away. They're actually paying them $3 per million BTU, which is the American unit for energy. For those interested, that's roughly 1 cent per kilowatt hour, roughly. Why was that happening? Because natural gas arrives in tandem with shale oil extraction. And the combination of boosted oil production due to the Straits of Hormuz situation and some gas pipes being out of commission, the producers had, and I'm quoting, a whole lot of gas with nowhere to go. Hence, they were paying people to take it away. We'll give you links to related posts for that. Okay, a little quick side trip, a hotter tip for a cooler planet. With winter creeping up, a great energy and money-saving trick is put on a jersey before you put on a heater. With a modest heater costing, say, 60 cents an hour to run, it's not hard to save $10 a week or more. And that also reduces pressure to burn coal at Huntly. And goodness me, we do want to minimize burning coal at Huntly. Finally, a little comment on a reference to another thoughtful Substack. I've entitled it CPR for a Planet, which is actually the title of the Substack. I've only recently started reading Lyle Lewis's thoughtful Substacks. I really like them, and I want to give them a plug because he weaves unusual strands of thoughts into his post. He's not a sort of tub-thumping sort of person, but they're quite gentle in a way, very thoughtful, and often threading in information that you or I might not be aware of. CPR for a Planet, there'll be a link in the show notes. Well, that's it for today, except in a moment there'll be a tribute to the music. So thank you very much for your company. I do hope I enjoy it again next week. And, of course, kia kaha for the climate. The remarkable story of the theme music, I'll also give a link to a page on my company's website with that. Lots of people say, oh, I feel I should know that music, but I can't quite place it. And that's not surprising because the music is essentially Vivaldi's famous four seasons, as in the digit four. But this one is called Four Seasons, F-O-R, and it's a brilliant yet heart-wrenching adaptation of the famous violin concertos, because they're modified to reflect climate change. using the original score, meteorological history, that's the history of the weather in an area, and artificial intelligence guided by composers and data experts, the changes were orchestrated to the music to reflect changes in the climate since Vivaldi wrote the music about 300 years ago. With the same only different feel starting in familiar territory, if you listen to the whole thing, we obviously only played snippets, obviously, but becoming increasingly deranged, the music is the brainchild of the Elbe Philharmonie Orchestra in Hamburg in Germany. So I hope that's a little bit of interest. Thank you to Vivaldi and Elbe Philharmonie for that great music. We are now moving on, but here it is for the last time.
The podcast you just listened to was a live recording of a radio show, first broadcast by Fresh FM, with support from New Zealand On Air. Fresh FM is a community access media station based in Te Tauihu, the top of the South Island, New Zealand. The funding of Access Media makes these podcasts possible. To find similar programs by other community media stations, go online to accessmedia.nz. If you or your group would like to know more about how you can have a program on our station, please contact us. Visit our website, freshfm.co.nz, for our contact details.